Well, let me continue this presentation by looking at a list of different uses of the term practice. In some contexts, it is used to underline an interesting combination of the day-to-day performance and its long-term character. This can be seen in paragraph 197 in Philosophical Investigations, where Wittgenstein asks how the rules of a game are connected with the request, "Let's play a game of chess." His answer is, well, in the list of rules of the game, in the teaching of it, in the day-to-day practice of playing. In another paragraph, also belonging to his discussion of rule following, Professor Anscombe has used practice as a translation for the German Übung, exercise. This occurs in Philosophical Investigations 208, paragraph 208, where Wittgenstein reflects upon how we should explain the meaning of the word regular, uniform, and same to someone who does not yet master the concepts expressed by these words. Wittgenstein phrases his answer like this, quote, "But if a person has not yet got the concept, I shall teach him to use the words by means of examples and by practice. And when I do this, I do not communicate less to him than I know myself." End quote. This is an appropriate translation, I think, indicating a kind of connection between the quasi-technical term Abrichtung and practice. Obviously, the day-to-day practice implies an element of training or exercise, which is one of the ordinary senses of the term practice, both in England and English and in German, and for that matter in Norwegian too. In passing, we should also take note of the similarity between on certainty, paragraph 139, which I've quoted to you, concerning the establishment of practices and the way language teaching is done in the basic cases of according to paragraph 208 in Philosophical Investigation. This last paragraph hints at the complete character of the communication that take place in the teaching. This is a significant remark, since it connects with the theme of the limits of language and what can get expressed in words and therefore be said to be known in any straightforward sense of that word. And that takes us back to the idea of Vorwissen, practice as an expression of pre-knowledge, knowledge that cannot be expressed verbally in an adequate way. We have already noted this idea in connection with Wittgenstein's remark about theology fumbling around with words. Theology attempts to say something of importance but does not know how to express it, as Wittgenstein puts it. This is not so because theology lacks the right words to say what it has to say. It is more like the loving person who expresses his love by caressing the beloved. The message is expressed by being practiced. The really important thing in the life of human beings are not expressible in words. They take the form of deeds. That is also the reason why Wittgenstein quotes Goethe's Faust with such confidence. Im Anfang war die Tat. Thus we see that a whole nest of important themes meets at exactly those places where Wittgenstein makes use of the term practice, or Praxis auf Deutsch. And this term and its English equivalent are directly involved in his analysis of rule following. Let me then return to Gordon Baker's view of what is involved in calling rule following a practice. For him, this is only a matter of regularities in behavior that performs the task of underpinning the unity of our concepts, as he puts it. This view is presented in the midst of an attempt to spell out a distinction between rules as instruments and the application of these instruments as rule following. Baker makes a lot of helpful and clarifying observations in the course of elucidating this distinction. Among other things, he convincingly shows how many very different things can be said to be expressions of rules in Wittgenstein apart from sentences. And he gives a few examples. Traffic lights, color charts, signposts, measuring rods, and authoritative examples showing how to behave in certain circumstances, for instance, in church. Quite a good bunch of things we don't do in church, which we do elsewhere, for instance. But there is also a tendency in Baker to be over fascinated by the rule aspects of rule following activities at the expense of the actual doing that are also involved. It is the practice aspect of rule following. I presume that this rule fixation is the reason why Baker states that, quote, there is no such thing as a hidden or hitherto unacknowledged yet operative rule, unquote. If anything is to have the status of a rule in the use of language, it must already be acknowledged as a rule by the speaker. We have to be able to relate to them as rules. According to Baker, it is in fact impossible to discover, quote, rules of grammar, games, laws, etc. They are made up of rules and we can't help focusing on the rules. But such a view flies in the face of some of the most important things Wittgenstein has to say about rule-following activities. Analyzing certain aspects of our ability to see something as something, Wittgenstein makes the following remark. We talk, we utter words, and only later get a picture of their lives. If this is a reliable description of what in fact goes on in a central area of our language use, then certainly there can be operative rules that are, at least for a while, unacknowledged. This also applies to situations. where new language games come into existence. They, according to Wittgenstein, are said to be spontaneously created. In his discussion of emotion concepts and what is involved in learning them, Wittgenstein once more touches upon situations in which rules may not always be fully acknowledgeable. Is there such a thing as an expert judgment about the genuineness of expressions of feeling, Wittgenstein asks, and gives us an affirmative answer. Even here, it is possible to distinguish between a better and a worse judgment. Some people simply have a better judgment of men. This is Menschenkenntnis for those who speak German here. And then Wittgenstein poses the question, can one learn Menschenkenntnis, this knowledge? Yes, some can. Not, however, by taking a course, but through experience. Can someone else be a man's teacher in this? Certainly. From time to time, he gives him the right tip. This is what learning and teaching is like here. What one acquires here is not a technique. One learns correct judgments. There are also rules, but they do not form a system, and only experienced people can apply them right. Unlike calculating rules. End quote. You find this in Philosophical Investigation, Part 2, page 227, if you have the classical edition of that book. Here we find Wittgenstein saying that in situations involving different aspects of Menschenkenntnis, or knowledge of human beings, or there are only hints or tips to go by when we are picking up the use of words that are needed for articulating this kind of knowledge. What is learned, moreover, are not rules. It is correct judgments, according to Wittgenstein. And quote, only in scattered cases can one establish a fruitful connection between these correct judgments, unquote. This does not exclude all talk of rules or similar things, but they are hard to come by and can only be applied by experienced persons. This is, of course, due to the fact that they have to be extracted from our natural reactions to other people. Only in that context is it possible to talk about rules at all. This should take care of Baker's inclination to give the rule aspect, a rule following, more than its due share when explicating Wittgenstein's picture of language as a complex manifold of rule-governed activities essentially involved in the use of meaningful signs. But what about the practice aspects of rule following? What has he to say about these regularities in our behavior that uphold the unity of concepts, as Baker is so keen on pointing out? Next to nothing, except for the reference to agreement in judgment. He suggests that measuring could profitably be seen as the model for following a rule. Such a model correctly emphasizes that it is a matter of publicly noticeable ways of acting for which there exists right and wrong ways of performance. But it also brings Baker onto the verge of ascribing a sort of decisionism to Wittgenstein, since the description of the model is taken to include, quote, singling out certain instruments and formulating rules for their use, unquote. So this leads nowhere. We have to look for help elsewhere if we are to go into the depth of the practice aspect of rule following. Colin McGinn is another philosopher who has looked into this matter, and he has rather carefully scrutinized the relevant paragraphs in Philosophical Investigations to decide what role the concept of practice and custom play in Wittgenstein's later philosophy. McGinn develops the idea that describing rule following as a practice, that in doing this, Wittgenstein is suggesting the interrelatedness of three different elements, all central to his later philosophy. And he has the following in mind. One, rule following takes place in the sphere of actual behavior and not in the inner recesses of a person's consciousness or mental mechanisms. When a person follows a signpost, his behavior is rule following. It is not an inner process that gets translated into overt behavior. Two, rules can be grasped only if they are actually obeyed repeatedly. This is to be understood in the following way. If any rules are to be grasped, some must be obeyed more than once. And this is said to imply that, quote, the very existence of meaning requires repeated use. Three, using and reacting to signs is properly seen as habitual and unreflective, not as the upshot of ratiocination. A practice is something that gets established on the basis of tradition. People find themselves conforming to practices or customs. No reasons are adduced to justify them. I think this is a better picture of what you can find in these paragraphs where Wittgenstein discusses rule following. And I wouldn't for a moment deny that the elements listed here play an important part in Wittgenstein's later philosophy. Neither would I wish to deny that they are intimately connected with the concept of practice as it can be observed at work in several different places in Wittgenstein's Nachlass. I would object, though, if it were suggested that this was all there is to it. I shall probably have to make that protest, since I'm afraid the above analysis is what we get if we try to spell out what Baker has to say about the concept of practice. A practice is, in his perspective, is thought of as an overt and repeated behavior originating in tradition. In this capacity, it does its job as underpinning the unity of our concepts, as I have repeatedly said. With the exception of the tradition part, I think this is a rough approximation of what Baker would be able to subscribe to concerning the explication of Wittgenstein's reference to the concept of practice in connection with rule following. Even if one does not want to take into consideration the clues to understanding the role of the concept of practice that I have already provided, something of great importance seems to be lacking in this explication. That is the part practice has to play in determining sense, according to Wittgenstein. There can be no doubt about that, since it is said in so many words by Wittgenstein himself that practice gives word their meaning. Instead, Baker is inclined to talk about the agreement in judgment as supplying or securing the unity of our concepts, thus hinting at an internal relationship between the concept of practice and what Wittgenstein, in that very decisive paragraph in Philosophical Investigations 242, calls agreement in judgment. This kind of agreement is, moreover, said to be the condition for the possibility of mutual understanding in language at all. We shall therefore have to look at this a bit and take this suggestion seriously. But first, I want to take a closer look once more at the context of the paragraph 202 in Philosophical Investigations, to see if it is possible to read it in such a way that there is a question of practice determining sense cannot be overlooked. For this purpose, I take the immediately preceding paragraph to be decisive. The remark in 202 might then be construed as a kind of conclusion to the problem raised in the preceding paragraph. If this is accepted, we can get the following picture of the role of the concept of practice here at work. The concept of practice is, in Wittgenstein's text, called upon to solve the paradox that he develops when investigating what is involved in saying that we do act according to rules. Wittgenstein outlines the conceptual conflict in this way. Quote, "No course of action would be determined by a rule, because every course of action can be made out to accord with the rule." Unquote. This seems to be completely detrimental to our most deeply ingrained intuition in these matters. Wittgenstein's next remark complicates things still more. He states that if everything can be made out to accord with a rule, it can also be made out to conflict with it. And so there would be neither accord nor conflict here. This shows the full extent of the predicament we find ourselves in at this point. Whatever we do is, on one interpretation, in accord with the rule, and on another interpretation, in conflict with the very same rule. This is, of course, an impossible situation, and Wittgenstein's way out is to insist that, quote, "there is a way of grasping a rule which is not an interpretation, but which is exhibited in what we call obeying a rule and going against it in actual cases. This is the kind of problem that makes Wittgenstein say in the following remark, and hence also following a rule is a practice. And that's the key remark. Yeah. As I see it, the most important thing here is that interpretation and practice are made out to be opposites. Interpretation is to Wittgenstein something that involves conscious intellectual activity. To interpret is to form an hypothesis. But such an hypothesis or interpretation can in no way be said to determine meaning. That, however, is exactly what a practice is supposed to do, as we have already had occasion to notice. Note also that the close similarity between these passages in Philosophical Investigations and the passage concerning the establishment of a practice quoted earlier from certainty, rules have loopholes open and the practice has to speak for itself. The point of this opposition between interpretation and practice should by now be hopefully rather clear. Wittgenstein is reaching for some means to make his reader realize that there is more to knowing the meaning of a word than abstractly knowing the rules according to which a word is used. And this additional element is brought out with the help of the concept of practice. For this non-interpretative way of grasping a rule is thought of as a kind of rock bottom that is involved in all concept formation or determination of sense. It follows that rules are necessarily related to established ways of following them. And that seems to be an interesting twist. That has as a consequence that rules actually get their identity from the very practices in which they are embedded. As such, they can never be fully understood except by those who can successfully perform the practices in question. In all determination of sense, there does seem to be involved an element of skill as well as an element of familiarity with the actual phenomena concerned, those who are conceptualized or according to which the rule is established. This is so since there can be no mastery of a practice without this being the case. But on the other hand, we seem to be up against the limits of language, at least in three different senses. First, this peculiar grasping of the rule that is expressed in correctly performing the practices in which the rule is embedded cannot itself be communicated by means of language. This is where the examples come in. Also, examples are needed for establishing a practice, as Wittgenstein has said it on certainty, and which I have quoted several times already. The same idea, or a related idea, I would rather say, is stated in Zettel, where we find Wittgenstein saying, quote, "I cannot describe how, in general, to employ rules except by teaching you, training you to employ rules. The teaching, the training is repeatedly mentioned and pointed to in this connection. The point is, however, not that the pupil should be able to recognize something in the examples that an experienced user of language cannot for some reason say or state verbally. This much is clear from Wittgenstein's discussion of family resemblance as an adequate expression of the kind of unity most concepts possess. He puts his point in the following way in those very famous remarks from 65 to 67 in Philosophical Investigations. One gives examples and intends them to be taken in a particular way. I do not, however, mean by this that he is supposed to see in those examples that common thing which I, for some reason, was unable to express, but that he is now to employ those examples in a particular way. He is taught to employ them in a certain way. Here again, we find Wittgenstein emphasizing the activity aspect of language training, that is, the practice aspect of rule following that consists in learning to do things the way things are done. The essential thing is that he actually employs the examples in the way he is intended to use them. This means that there must be accepted ways of performing practices, since it does make a difference to what we do as participants in a practice. Practices might thus be said to have a logical grammar that is at least partly expressed by inherited ways of doing things. Here, the inherited way of making empirical judgment, as commented upon in Uncertainty, comes to my mind. Quote, "We do not learn the practice of making empirical judgment by learning rules. We are taught judgments and their connection with other judgments. From child up, I learned to judge like this. This is judging. This is how I learned to judge. This I got to know as judgment." The point here is not only that we have taken over certain ways of exploring and judging the empirical world from earlier generations. It is just as important to note that in this context, exploring and judging is conceived of as ways of acting. This may be somewhat more clearly stated in paragraph 144 in Uncertainty, where Wittgenstein says that, quote, "The child learns to believe a host of things. It learns to act according to these beliefs." Unquote. And this cannot be learned by learning rules. That is why the practice aspect of rule following cannot be taught on the basis of rules. It has to be picked up by examples and by training. Second, we are up against the limits of language in another, though related, sense. Our acting is said to lie at the bottom of our language games, as Wittgenstein says in Uncertainty. Moreover, this acting is done with complete certainty. It's uncertainty. You find this. There is no room for doubt. Wittgenstein puts it this way, quote, "Somewhere I must begin with non-doubting, and that is part of judging," unquote. This certainty Wittgenstein would like to regard as a form of life. That is one of the places where this very special expression occurs. This connects the practice aspects of rule following with the given, since what has to be accepted, the given, is, so one could say, forms of life. And third, we are up against the limits of language in yet another sense. For this acting of ours that is said to lie at the bottom of our language game is in another place straightforwardly characterized as the limit of the empirical. In the remarks on the foundations of mathematics, this is stated in so many words. Quote, "The limits of the empirical are ways of comparing and ways of acting." Nothing more, nothing less. The ways of comparing referred to here are probably of two different kinds. We have the paradigm mentioned in paragraph 50 in Philosophical Investigation, quote, "with which comparison is made," unquote. A paradigm in this sense is part of a method of representation and thus already at hand in a non-eliminative way. The other kind of comparison that plays an important role in Wittgenstein is the one that is invented to make you see some aesthetic phenomenon in a proper light or to dissolve an aesthetic puzzle. Quote, "What we really want to solve aesthetic puzzlements is certain comparisons, grouping together of certain cases," unquote. This is in the fourth lecture on aesthetics, edited by Cyril Barrett. The second type of comparison Wittgenstein also uses in his new philosophical method, as reported by George Edward Moore. That is also from a lecture on aesthetics. That is from 1933. "Reasons," he said, "in aesthetics are of the nature of further descriptions. All that aesthetic does is to draw your attention to a thing, to place things side by side." And he said that the same sort of reasons were given also in philosophy. So there is an interesting similarity there. This similarity in method Wittgenstein once commented upon by pointing out, quote, "the queer resemblance between a philosophical investigation and an aesthetic one," and the relationship between these two kinds of comparisons is this: the creative and surprising use of the second make you realize the existence of the first. And the first is said to be part of the limits of the empirical. Besides, making a comparison is still another way of acting. So, in either way, we end up with different ways of acting. The practice aspect of rule following as that which has to speak for itself. This striking connection between the practice aspects of rule following and the limits of language might be the basis for Baker's seeing a sort of internal relationship between agreement in judgment and rule following conceived as practice. But as we have already seen, this agreement in judgment is, in its turn, understood as regularities in behavior, which incidentally is also Baker's key to understanding the concept of practice, as I have remarked earlier on. No wonder they seem to him to be internally related. And certainly they are. On the other hand, it is far from clear what Baker subsumes under the expression regularities of behavior. I think, however, that it would not be far off the mark to suggest that what he most of all has in mind is our common way of responding to teaching and training that we are exposed to, thus ensuring the public features of the use of the measuring instrument that serves him as a model in rule following. This is all important to him, since he conceives use or application in terms of criteria. Quote, "There are indeed criteria for whether someone is measuring an object, also criteria for whether he has measured it correctly. Like all criteria, these ones are public and defeasible." Unquote. This also explains why Baker is so insistent upon about the overt character of the practices. Only that can provide public criteria. If this is all there is to understanding of to his understanding of agreement in judgment, it is not unfair to indicate that it is not sufficiently comprehensive. It is possible to distinguish three different, though closely related, senses of the term agreement in judgment in Wittgenstein's later philosophy. One, there is uniformity in the instinctive reactions we have towards certain types of stimuli, for instance, friendly faces contra unfriendly ones, a pointing hand, sources of sound which we respond immediately to, etc. Two, there is a uniformity in the unreflective certainty with which we act in ordinary cases, ordinary situations. When we get up from our chair, for instance, we take it for granted that our feet still are there and that the ground will carry us. Wittgenstein's examples in uncertainty. Three, there is uniformity in the way we treat the judgments that stand fast for us. That's Wittgenstein's expression. This shows up in the fact that, quote, we use judgments as principles of judgments, unquote. In all these areas, we are justified in talking about agreement in judgments. Each of these ways of agreeing in judgment can separately be thought of as a condition for the possibility of establishing a system of meaningful signs. We have to respond instinctively to friendly faces and to unfriendly ones. This is implied in Wittgenstein's reported remark, quote, "The child understands the gestures which you use in teaching him. If he did not, he could not understand anything at all. Unquote. We have to act with unreflective certainty in ordinary cases. Otherwise, there will be no judging games at all, since such certainty is said to be part of judging. And we have to treat the judgments that stand fast for us in a uniform way, since these judgments are involved in all the other language games we learn to play. Quote, very famous, "If I want the door to turn, the hinges must stay put." This is approximately what we get if we interpret the expression agreement in judgment rather more comprehensively than does Bacon. And it is the case that the term rule, agreement, and same always go together. It is not far-fetched to maintain that this is what the practice aspect of rule following is all about. And if this point of view is accepted, it is not so difficult to understand why practices has to speak for themselves. It is, in fact, and of necessity, inexpressible, the practice as such. In this perspective, there is no problem saying that the mastery of a practice is the tacit expression of a kind of understanding or foreism, which is shown in correctly executing the sayings and doings that make up the practice. I'm sorry it took a bit longer than I had hoped, but this gives you a picture of the discussion that took place concerning this very pivotal concept of practice and its connection with rule following. There are very many questions involved in this, and even if we follow that up, a kind of tacit knowing could be developed from this, but that I have done elsewhere.